There was an air of holiday that hardly paused for blessing over the food, and that erupted full blast before the echo of the Amen died. Liddy, her feet alternately sloshing about and being pinched by Tryphena's shoes, determinedly helped Tim serve both large tables. They brought in great platters of fried cod, hash, potato balls, pumpkin mash with huge pitchers of cream, toast and butter, apple pie, and pitchers of coffee and milk. Liddy had never seen harvesters eat so much or so noisily, and these were supposed to be ladies.
"Hello there,"
a voice cut through the din.
"We didn't really meet ya."
The room was suddenly quiet.
"Don't be rude, Betsy," another said. "She was tired last night."
Liddy turned to see who had said this last, because it was her idea of a lady's voice. The young woman who had spoken was smiling.
"You only came in last night, didn't you, my dear?"
Liddy nodded.
"There, don't be shy. We were all new once, even our Betsy."
There was a titter from the rest.
"I'm Amelia Kate." Her name was aristocratic. Amelia. It suited her. She was almost as pretty as the lady in pink that had come through the inn last year. Her skin was white, and her face and hands long and delicate, and she was respected, or the others wouldn't have stopped chattering when she spoke.
"And you?"
"Liddy Worthen. Lydia Worthen."
With a rough finger, she scratched at the tight homespun across her chest. It seemed to Liddy that the room was full of young women, all well-dressed, all delicate, all beautiful. And she, a crow among peacocks.
"Vermont, isn't it?"
said the one called Betsy, and a few of the others laughed.
"What's the matter with Vermont?"
The voice had a bare trace of a Green Mountain twang.
"I'm from near Rutland myself. Where do you hail from, Liddy?"
Liddy turned to see a girl not much older than herself, but, like all the others, whiter of complexion. She had light hair braided in a crown about her head, and a serious face that a few freckles failed to relieve. Liddy pulled at her own straggly brown plaits, grateful when attention shifted and the room was once again filled with chattering. After breakfast, Amelia and the Rutland girl, whose name was Prudence Allen, offered to take her shopping for a proper dress, work apron, shoes, and bonnet. As they were leaving, Mrs. Bedloe pressed something into Amelia's hand, which turned out to be a dollar that Mrs. Bedloe claimed was a payment from her roguish brother for damages to Liddy's clothing on the way. Much to Liddy's distress, it took all the money she had left, including the coachman's dollar, to dress her in a manner that satisfied Amelia and Prudence. She was so pained at the waste of money that she couldn't enjoy any of the new things, though she was pressed to wear the shoes home. In her heart, she knew that she had never had a better-fitting pair. Even the stiffness that she felt around the toes and heels and ankles was simply a reminder that she had on grand new city boots. When they were broken in, she would be able to walk anywhere in such shoes, even home. Liddy never quite knew how it was decided, but Mrs. Bedloe told her that evening that she would move her things from the attic to Amelia and Prudence's room on the third floor. The other girls might grumble, which indeed they did, being passed over for a choice room by a newcomer, but Amelia had persuaded Mrs. Bedloe that since Liddy had no relatives or friends in the house, indeed in the city, she needed their particular caring. Mrs. Bedloe, still feeling guilty about her brother, gave in. So Liddy was moved to a smaller bedroom on the third floor to be with Amelia, Prudence, and the obviously disgruntled Betsy, who, since their previous roommate had gone home to New Hampshire the week before, had had the luxury of a bed to herself. Four to a room was, in itself, a luxury, as most of the rooms held six. But even so, there was hardly any space to walk around the two double beds, the two tiny nightstands, and the various trunks and bandboxes of the inhabitants. There was no place to sit except on the beds, but then, on a regular workday, there was no leisure time, except the less than 3 hours between supper and curfew. Most of the girls spent their short measure of free time down in the parlor dining room, or out in town where there were shops and lectures and even dances, all run by honest citizens bent on parting the working girls from their wages. "Now," said Amelia, who was far more conscientious about her duties as caretaker than Liddy would have wished, "where will you be going to church on the Sabbath?" Liddy looked up in alarm. Living as far as they had from the village, the Worthens had never even bothered to pay pew rent in the village congregational church.
I hadn't thought to go.
Amelia sighed, reminding Liddy that she was proving a harder case than the older girl had bargained for.
"Oh, but you must," she said.
"What Amelia means," Betsy said, looking up from her novel, "is that regardless of the state of your immortal soul, the corporation requires regular attendance of all its girls. It makes us look respectable, even those of us who waste our precious minds on novels."
"Oh, do behave yourself, Betsy."
"Sorry, Amelia, but if I let you carry on about her moral duties when the girl plainly has no notion of them herself, this conversation will last all night."
She put down her book and looked Liddy straight in the face.
"They'll probably make you put in an appearance from time to time somewhere. The Methodists don't press girls for pew rent, so if you're short on money, best go there. You have to pay for it in longer sermons, but nonetheless, I always recommend the Methodists to new girls with no particular desire to go anywhere."
"Betsy!"
"Betsy likes to sound shocking," Prudence explained patiently. "Don't take it to heart."
She was brushing out her long blonde hair and looked like a princess in a fairy tale, though her voice was far too matter-of-fact for a storybook.
"But how should Liddy explain it? But ain't Massachusetts a free country?"
"Of course, my dear," Amelia said. "But there are rules and regulations here, as in any civilized establishment. They are meant for our own good, my dear. You'll see."
Betsy rolled her eyes and went back to her novel. The next morning, Mrs. Bedloe led Liddy down the street past all the corporation boarding houses to the bridge that led to the factory complex. Between two low brick buildings was a tall wooden fence. The gate of the fence was locked, like a jail yard, but Mrs. Bedloe wasn't deterred. She simply went to the door of one of the low buildings and walked in. Liddy followed, dragging her feet, for the room they entered was larger than the main floor of Cutler's Tavern, and it was crowded with tables and scrivener's desks. There were a few men working about the huge room, who looked up over their pens and account books as the two women passed, but it was clear that nothing much was being accomplished, even in the counting room, now that the water was too high to drive the mill wheel. Mrs. Bedloe walked straight through the room and out the door on the opposite side into a courtyard large enough, it seemed to Liddy, for the whole of their mountain farm to fit inside. The front gate and low south buildings, the counting house, offices, and storerooms, as Mrs. Bedloe explained, formed part of the enclosure. The two slightly shorter sides were taller frame structures, the machine shops and repair shops, and across the whole north end of the compound was the cotton mill itself, a gigantic six-story brick building. At one end ran the frame structure of the outdoor staircase. From the brick face, six even rows of windows seemed to glower down at her through the gray April drizzle like so many unfriendly eyes. A bell tower rose from the long roof, making the building seem even taller and more forbidding.
"It must seem imposing to a farm girl," Mrs. Bedloe said. Liddy nodded and tightened her grip on her shawl to keep from trembling. Mrs. Bedlow turned back toward the Low South building and knocked on a door marked Agent. "I've brought you a new girl," she said cheerily to the young man who opened the door. "Fresh from the farm and very healthy, as you can see." The young man hardly gave Liddy a glance, but stepped back and held the door for them to come in.
"I'll see if Mr. Graves can spare a minute," he said haughtily. "These clerks do put on airs," Mrs. Bedlow whispered, but if she was trying to make Liddy feel more at ease, she failed. Nor was the sight of the agent himself any comfort.
"Mrs. Bedlow, isn't it?"
He was a fat, prosperous-looking man, but without the manners to stand when a middle-aged lady came into his office. Mrs. Bedlow talked very fast, her face flushed. Liddy was sure the man would turn them both away. He looked barely patient as Mrs. Bedlow rattled on. But, in the end, he said he would give Liddy a contract for 1 year. There was a shortage in the weaving room at the moment. Mr. Thurston, the clerk, would give the girl the broadside with the regulations for the Concord and arrange for her to have her smallpox vaccination the following morning. They were dismissed with a nod. Mrs. Bedlow punched Liddy and prompted her to thank the agent for his kindness. Liddy's voice could hardly manage a whisper, but it didn't matter. The gentleman wasn't paying her any attention. She signed the paper where the clerk pointed, tried to listen carefully to all his warnings about what the contract demanded, and stuffed the broadside that he handed her into her apron pocket. She would study it tonight, she decided, her heart sinking. She could tell at a glance that it would be almost impossible for her to make out the meaning of such a paper. Oh, if only Charlie were here to read it aloud to her and explain the long words. Factory girls were not supposed to be ignorant, it would seem. It would be several months before she could read with ease the regulations of the boarding houses of the Concord Corporation. But she found out the next day that it concealed unpleasant truths. The first of these was the vaccination. Mrs. Bedlow marched her over to the hospital after dinner, where a doctor cruelly gouged her leg and poured a mysterious liquid directly into the wound. Liddy was even more distressed when the wound turned into a nasty sore in a few days' time, but she was only laughed at for her distress and told it was all for her own good. She'd never get the pox now, so she should be grateful. Amelia, indeed, was always instructing her to be grateful about things that Liddy, try as she might, could not summon the least whiff of gratitude over. But finally, when she had been alternately shocked and bored for the better part of 2 weeks, the announcement was made at supper that work was to begin again the next day, and Liddy felt a surge of gratitude that her days of idleness were over. She would be a true factory girl in a few hours' time. Liddy was mostly disappointed, but perhaps a tiny bit relieved, when Mrs. Bedlow announced that she would take her over to the weaving room after dinner. The large noonday meal must be out of the way and the dishes washed before the housekeeper could spare a moment, she said. Besides, it wouldn't do to be totally worn out on the first day. 4 hours would be plenty to start with. The gate was locked. "They don't want tardy girls slipping past," Mrs. Bedlow explained. "You must always take care to be here when the bell rings." They entered the factory complex through the counting room as they had 2 weeks before, but this time it was teeming with men all dressed like gentlemen. Every head seemed to rise and every eye looked their way. Despite her new clothes, Liddy could feel the shame burning through her rough brown cheeks. She ducked her bonneted head and hurried through as fast as she could, almost shoving Mrs. Bedlow in her haste. Once in the yard, she was acutely aware of the thudding. The pulse of the factory boomed through the massive brick wall, and she could feel the vibrations of the machinery as they made their way up the shadowy wooden staircase, which clung for dear life to the side of the building.
Mrs. Bedloe huffed ahead, stopping more than once to catch her breath on the climb to the fourth floor. Once there, she jerked open the door, and the thudding beat exploded into a roar. She gave Liddy a little push toward the racket.
"Mr. Marsden is expecting you," she yelled. "He'll see you settled in."
And she was gone. Chapter 9. The Weaving Room.
Creation! What a noise! Clatter and clack, great shuddering moans, groans, creaks, and rattles. The shrieks and whistles of huge leather belts on wheels. And when her brain cleared enough, Liddy saw through the murky air row upon row of machines, eerily like the old hand loom in Quaker Stevens's house, but as unlike as a nightmare, for these creatures had come to life. They seemed moved by eyes alone, the eyes of neat, vigilant young women, needing only the occasional swift intervention of a human hand to keep them clattering. From the overarching metal frame crowning each machine, wooden harnesses carrying hundreds of warp threads drawn from a massive beam at the back of each loom clanked up and down. Shuttles holding the weft thread hurtled themselves like beasts of prey through the tall forests of warp threads, and beaters slammed the threads tightly into place. With alarming speed, inches of finished cloth rolled up on the beams at the front of the looms. The girls didn't seem afraid or even amazed. As she walked by with the overseer, girls glanced up. A few smiled, some stared. No one seemed to mind the deafening din. How could they stand it? She had thought a single stagecoach struggling to hold back the horses on a downhill run was unbearably noisy. A single stagecoach! A factory was 100 stagecoaches, all inside one skull, banging their wheels against the bone. Her impulse was to turn and run to the door, down the rickety stairs, through the yard and counting room, across the narrow bridge, past the row of boarding houses, down the street, out of this hellish city, and back, back, back to the green hills and quiet pastures. But of course, she didn't move a step. She didn't even cover her ears against the assault. She just stood quietly in front of the machine that the overseer had led her to and pretended she could hear what he was saying to her. His mouth was moving, a strange little red mouth peeping out from under his bushy black mustache. The luxuriant growth of the mustache was all the more peculiar because the overseer had hardly any hair on his head. His pate gleamed like polished wood. Suddenly, to Liddy's astonishment, the man put his red mouth quite close to her ear. She jerked her head away before she realized he was shouting the words,
"Is that quite clear?"
Liddy stared at him in terror. Nothing was clear at all. What did the man mean? Did he seriously think she could possibly have heard any of his mysterious mouthings? But how could she say she had heard nothing but the beastly racket of the looms? How could she say she could see hardly anything in the morning gloom of the huge barn-like room, the very air a soup of dust and lint? She was simply standing there, her mouth open with no words coming out, when an arm went around her shoulders. She shrank again from the touch before she saw it was one of the young women who tended the looms. Her head was close enough to Liddy's left ear so that Liddy could hear her say to the overseer,
"Don't worry, Mr. Marsden. I'll see she settles in."
The overseer nodded, obviously relieved not to have to deal with Liddy or the loom he'd assigned her.
"We'll work together," the girl shouted in her ear. "My two machines are just next to you here. I'm Diana."
She motioned for Liddy to stand close behind her right shoulder, so although Liddy wasn't in her way as she worked,
The older girl could speak into Liddy's left ear by turning her head slightly to the right. Suddenly, Diana banged a metal lever at the right of the machine and the loom shivered to a halt. At either end of the shed, made by the crisscrossing of warp threads, was a narrow wooden trough. From the trough on the left, she retrieved the shuttle. The shuttle was wood, pointed, and tipped at either end with copper. It was about the shape of a corn cob, only a little larger and hollowed out so that it could carry a bobbin or quill of weft thread. With her hands moving so quickly that Liddy could hardly follow them, Diana popped out a nearly empty quill of thread and thrust in a full one from a wooden box of bobbins near her feet. Then she put her mouth to a small hole near one end of the shuttle and sucked out the end of the weft thread.
"We call it the kiss of death," she shouted, smiling wryly to soften the words.
She pulled out a foot or more of the thread, wound it quickly around one of two iron hooks, and rehung the hooks into the last row of woven cloth. The hooks were attached by a yard or so of leather cord to a bell-shaped iron weight.
"You have to keep moving your temple hooks," Diana said. "Pulls the web down snug as you go."
She pointed to the new inches of woven fabric.
"Now," said Diana, speaking into Liddy's ear, "make sure the shuttle is all the way at the end of the race, always on your right here."
She placed the shuttle snug against the right-hand end of the trough.
"We don't want any flying shuttles." "All right, then, we're ready to go again."
Diana grasped the metal lever, pulled it toward the loom, and jammed it into a slot. The loom shuddered once more to life. For the first hour or so, Liddy watched, trying mostly to stay out of Diana's way as she moved among the three machines, two opposite and one adjoining. The older girl refilled the shuttles when they ran low and rehung the temple hooks to keep the web tight. Then, without warning, for no reason that Liddy could see, Diana slammed off one of the looms.
"See," she said, pointing at the shed. "A warp thread snapped. If we don't catch that, we're in trouble."
An empty shuttle might damage a few inches of goods, she explained, but a broken warp could leave a flaw through yards of cloth.
"We don't get paid when we ruin a piece."
She pinched a tiny bag hung from the metal frame of the loom. It spit out a puff of talc, which she rubbed into her fingertips. Then, fishing out the broken ends of warp, she showed Liddy how to fasten them together with a weaver's knot. When Diana tied the ends, they seemed to melt together, leaving the knot invisible. She stepped aside.
"Now, you start it," she said.
Liddy was a farm girl. She took pride in her strength, but it took all of her might to yank the metal lever into place. She broke into a sweat like some untried plow horse. The temples were not much larger than apples, but when Diana asked her to move one, she felt as though someone had tied a gigantic field stone to the end of the leather cord. Still, the physical strength the work required paled beside the dexterity needed to rethread a shuttle quickly, or, heaven help her, tie one of those infernal weaver's knots. Everything happened too fast. A bobbin of weft thread lasted hardly 5 minutes before it had to be replaced, and it was painfully deafening. But tall, quiet Diana moved from loom to loom like the silent angel in the lion's den, keeping Daniel from harm. There were moments when all three looms were running as they ought, all the shuttles bearing full quills, all three temples hung high on the cloth, no warp thread snapping. During one of these respites, Diana drew Liddy to the nearest window. The sill was alive with flowers blooming in pots, and around the frame someone had pasted single pages of books and magazines. Diana pressed down a curling corner of a poem. Most of the sheets were yellowing.
"Not so much time to read these days," Diana said. "We used to have more time. Do you like to read, Liddy?"
Liddy thought of the regulations that she was still trying laboriously to decipher when no one was looking.
"I've not much schoolin'."
"Well, you can remedy that," the older girl said. "I'll help, if you like, some evening."
Liddy looked up gratefully. She felt no need with Diana to apologize or be ashamed of her ignorance.
"I'm needing a bit of help with the regulations."
"I shouldn't wonder. They're a trial for us all," Diana said. "Why don't you bring the broadside over to number 3 tonight, and we'll slog through that wretched thing together?"
Amelia was not pleased that evening after supper when she realized that Liddy was getting ready to go out.
"Your first day. You ought to rest."
"I'm all right," said Liddy. And indeed, once the noise of the weaving room was out of her ears, she did feel quite all right. A bit tired, but certainly not over-weary.
"I aim to do a bit of studying," she said. It made her feel proud to say such a thing.
"Studying? With whom?"
"The girl I'm working with in the weaving room, Diana."
She realized that she didn't know Diana's surname. Amelia, Prudence, and Betsy worked in the spinning room on the 3rd floor, so she supposed they did not know Diana. Betsy looked up from her ever-present novel.
"Diana Goss?" she asked.
"I don't know. Just Diana. She was very kind to me today."
"Diana Goss?" echoed Amelia. "Oh, Liddy, don't be taken in."
Liddy couldn't believe her ears.
"Eh?"
"If it's Diana Goss," Prudence said, "she's a known radical, and Amelia is concerned."
"Eh?"
Betsy laughed.
"I don't think our little country cousin is acquainted with any radicals, known or unknown."
"I know Quakers," Liddy said. "Creation, they're abolitionists, every one, eh?"
"Hurrah for you!"
Betsy put down her novel and made a little show of clapping her hands. Amelia was sewing new ribbons on her Sunday bonnet, and watching Betsy's performance, managed to jab the needle into her finger instead of the hat brim. She stuck her finger in her mouth and looked up, annoyed.
"Oh, I wish you wouldn't keep saying things like creation and A, Liddy. It's so...
"Only the new girls from Vermont speak like that," said Prudence, whose own mountain speech was well tamed. Liddy didn't quite know what to do. She had no desire to anger her roommates, but she was quite set on going to see Diana. It wasn't just the foolish regulations. She wanted to learn everything, to become as quietly competent as the tall girl. She knew enough about factory life already to realize that good workers in the weaving room make good money. It wasn't like being a maid, where hard work only earned you a bonus in exhaustion.
"Well," she said, tying her bonnet, "I'll be back soon."
"I'd rather you wouldn't go at all," Amelia said coolly.
Liddy smiled. She didn't mean to seem unfriendly or even ungrateful, though it was tiresome to be always beholden to Amelia.
"I don't want you to worry after me. I'm able to do for myself, eh?"
"Ha!"
Betsy's short laugh came out like a snort.
"It's just," Prudence said, "it's just that you haven't been here long enough to know about certain things. Amelia doesn't... well, none of us want you to find yourself in an awkward situation."
For a moment, Liddy was afraid that Amelia or even Prudence would start in to lecture her, so she grabbed her shawl and said as she was moving out of the bedroom door,
"I'll watch out,"
though what she was promising to look out for, she had no idea. Diana's boarding house was only 2 houses away from her own. The architecture was identical. A 4-story brick building, lined with rows of windows that blinked like sleepy eyes as lamps and candles were lit against the dusk of an April evening. The front door was unlocked, so she walked into the large front room, like Mrs. Bedloe's, nearly filled with 2 large dining tables, but with the semblance of a living area on one side. And just as in Mrs. Bedloe's parlor, chairs had been pulled away from the tables, and girls were chatting and sewing and reading in the living area.
It was as noisy and busy as a chicken yard. Peddlers had come off the street to tempt the girls with ribbons and cheap jewelry. A local phrenologist was in one corner measuring a girl's skull and preparing to read her character from his findings. Several girls were watching this consultation, transfixed. Liddy pushed the door shut, but stood just inside, uncertain how to proceed. How could she ask for Diana when she wasn't even sure of her proper name? But she needn't have worried. Out of the chattering mass of bodies, Diana rose from her chair in the corner and came to where Liddy stood. She smiled, and her long, serious face creased into dimples.
"I'm so glad you came. Let's go upstairs, where we can speak in something less than a shout."
What a relief it was to climb the stairs and leave most of the racket two floors behind. There was no one else in Diana's room. "What a treat," Diana said, as though reading Liddy's mind. "Sometimes I'd sell my soul for a moment of quiet, wouldn't you?" Liddy nodded. She suddenly felt shy around Diana, who seemed even more imposing away from the looms when her lovely, elegant voice was pitched rich and low, like the call of a mourning dove.
"First, we need to get properly introduced," she said. "I'm Diana Goss."
She must have noted a flicker of something in Liddy's face, because she added, "The infamous Diana Goss," and dimpled into her lovely smile. Liddy reddened.
"So you've been warned?"
"Not really."
"Well, then, you will be. I'm a friend of Sarah Bagley's."
She watched Liddy's face for reaction to the name, and when she got none, tried another.
"Amelia Sargent?"
"Mary Emerson?"
"Huldah Stone?"
"No?"
"Well, you'll hear those names soon enough. Our crime has been to speak out for better working conditions."
She looked at Liddy again. "Yes. Why, then, should the operatives themselves fear us? It is, dear Liddy, the nature of slavery to make the slave fear freedom."
"I'm not a slave,"
Liddy said, more fiercely than she intended.
"You're not here for a lecture. I'm sorry. Tell me about yourself."
It was hard for Liddy to talk about herself. She'd had no practice. With Amelia and Prudence and Betsy, she didn't need to. They, especially Amelia, seemed always to be telling her about herself, or trying to make her like themselves. Besides, what was interesting about her? What would someone like Diana want to know?
"There's Charlie,"
she began, and before she knew it, she was explaining that she was here to earn the money to pay off her father's debts so she and Charlie could go home. Diana did not smile ironically or laugh as Betsy was sure to. She did not once lecture her as though she were a slow child the way Amelia often did, or offer a single explanation as Prudence would have felt obliged to. No, the tall girl perched on the edge of a bed and listened silently and intently until Liddy ran out of story to tell. Liddy was a bit breathless, never having said so many words in the space of so few minutes in her life, and then, embarrassed to have talked so long about herself, she asked,
"But I reckon you know how it is with families, eh?"
"Not really. I can hardly remember mine. Only my aunt that kept me until I was 10, and she's gone now."
Liddy made as if to sympathize, but Diana shook it off. "I think of the mill as my family. It gives me plenty of sisters to worry about." "But," she said, "I don't think I need to worry about you. You don't know what it is not to work hard, do you?"
"I don't mind work. The noise," Diana laughed.
"Yes, the noise is terrible at the beginning, but you get accustomed to it somehow."
Liddy found that hard to believe, but if Diana said so. "And I don't suppose you think a 13-hour day overly long, either." Liddy's days had never been run on clocks.
"I just work until the work is done," she said, but I never had leave to go paying calls in the evenings before.
And the wages seem fair? I ain't been paid yet, but from what I hear,
what did you get at the inn?
I don't know, 50 cents the week, I think. They sent it to Mama. Tryphena said the mistress was like to forget as not. I suppose Charlie...
Liddy stopped speaking. Neither Charlie nor her mother knew where she was.
Is something the matter, Liddy?
I haven't wrote them. Charlie, nor my mother. They don't know where I am.
Suppose they needed her. How could they find her? Liddy felt the panic rising. She was cut off from them all. She might as well have gone to the other side of the world. She was out of their reach.
When will they pay me?
If it's paper you need.
It's postage, too. I'd have to prepay. They don't have the money to pay at that end.
I could manage postage.
I can't borrow. I borrowed too much already.
But Diana quietly insisted. Liddy owed it to her family to let them know right away, she said. She brought out paper, pen, and ink, and a sturdy board for Liddy to write upon. Liddy would have felt shy about forming her letters so laboriously in front of Diana, but Diana took up a book and made Liddy feel as though she were alone.
Dear Mother, you will be surprised to know I am gone to Lowell to work. I am in the weaving room at the Concord Corp. I board at number 5 if you writ me. Everyone is kind, and the food is plenty and tasty. I am saving my money to pay the debts. I am well. I trust you and the babies are well, too. Your faithful daughter, Lydia Worthen.
It seemed extravagant to take another sheet to write to Charlie, but Diana had said that she ought to write him as well.
Dear brother, do not be surprised. I am gone to Lowell for a factory girl. Everyone is kind. The work is all right, but machines is nosy, believe me. The money is good. I will save and pay off the debts. So we can still hop. Ha ha. Your loving sister, Lydia Worthen. P.S. I am at Concord Corp. Number 5 if you can writ. Excuse all mistakes. I am in great hurry.
She folded the letters, sealed them with Diana's wax, and addressed them. Before she could ask further about posting them, Diana took the letters from her hand.
I have to go tomorrow anyhow. Let me mail them for you.
I'll pay you back as soon as I get paid, she sighed. As soon as I pay Tryphena.
No, said Diana. This time it's my welcoming gift. You mustn't try to repay a gift. The bell rang for curfew.
We haven't looked at the silly regulations, Diana said. Well, another time.
Diana walked her to number 5. It was a bright, cool night, though in the city the stars seemed dim and far away.
Until tomorrow, Diana said at the door.
I'm obliged to you for everything, Liddy said.
Diana shook her head. They need to know.
They'll worry.
The roommates were already getting into bed.
You're late, Amelia said.
I come as soon as the bell rung.
Oh, you're not really late, said Betsy. Amelia just doesn't approve of where you've been. It was Diana Goss, wasn't it?
Amelia asked.
Yes.
And?
Liddy was taking off her bonnet, then her shawl.
And what? What did Amelia mean?
Amelia answered her own question.
Did she try to make you join?
Liddy folded her shawl, still uncomprehending.
She means, said Betsy, did she tie you up and torture you until you promised to join the Female Labor Reform Association?
Oh, Betsy, said Prudence.
She never mentioned such, Liddy said.
She made her way around Amelia and Prudence's bed and trunks to the side of the bed that she shared with Betsy. She sat on the edge and began to take off her shoes and stockings.
"Then what were you doing all that time?"
Betsy slammed her book shut.
"What affair is it of yours, Amelia?"
"It's all right," Liddy said. She had no desire to get her roommates stirred up over nothing. "She just give me paper to write to my family to tell them where I was."
"Oh, Liddy," Prudence said. "How thoughtless of us. We never offered."
"No matter," Liddy said. "I done it now."
"She's devious," Amelia muttered. "You have to watch her. Believe me, Liddy, I'm only thinking of your own good."
Betsy snorted, reached over, and blew out the candle as the final curfew bell began to clang.
Chapter 10. Oliver. The 4:30 bell clanged the house awake. From every direction, Liddy could hear the shrill voices of girls calling to one another, even singing. Someone on another floor was imitating a rooster. From the other side of the bed, Betsy groaned and turned over. But Liddy was up, dressing quickly in the dark, as she had always done in the windowless attic of the inn. Her stomach rumbled, but she ignored it. There would be no breakfast until 7, and that was 2.5 hours away. By 5, the girls had crowded through the main gate, jostled their way up the outside staircase on the far end of the mill, cleaned their machines, and stood waiting for the workday to begin. "Not too tired this morning?" Diana asked by way of greeting. Liddy shook her head. Her feet were sore, but she'd felt tireder after a day behind the plow.
"Good. Today will be something more strenuous, I fear. We'll work all 3 looms together, all right? Until you feel quite sure of everything."
Liddy felt a bit as though the older girl were whispering in church. It seemed almost that quiet in the great loom room. The only real noise was the creaking from the ceiling of the leather belts that connected the wheels in the weaving room to the gigantic water wheel in the basement. The overseer came in, nodded good morning, and pushed a low wooden stool under a cord dangling from the assembly of wheels and belts above his head. His little red mouth pursed, he stepped up on the stool and pulled out his pocket watch. At the same moment, the bell in the tower above the roof began to ring. He yanked the cord. The wide leather belt above him shifted from a loose to a tight pulley, and suddenly all the 100 or so silent looms, in raucous concert, shuddered and groaned into fearsome life. Liddy's first full day as a factory girl had begun. Within 5 minutes, her head felt like a log being split to splinters. She kept shaking it, as though she could rid it of the noise, or at least the pain, but both only seemed to grow more intense. If that weren't trial enough, a few hours of standing in her proud new boots, and her feet had swollen so that the laces cut into her flesh. She bent down quickly to loosen them, and when she found the right lace was knotted, she nearly burst into tears. Or perhaps the tears were caused by the swirling dust and lint. Now that she thought of it, she could hardly breathe. The air was so laden with moisture and debris. She snatched a moment to run to the window. She had to get air, but the window was nailed shut against the April morning. She leaned her forehead against it. Even the glass seemed hot. Her apron brushed the pots of red geraniums crowding the wide sill. They were flourishing in this hothouse. She coughed, trying to free her throat and lungs for breath. Then she felt, rather than saw, Diana.
"Mr. Marsden has his eye on you," the older girl said gently, and put her arm on Liddy's shoulder to turn her back toward the looms. She pointed to the stalled loom and the broken warp thread that must be tied. Even though Diana had stopped the loom, Liddy stood rubbing the powder into her fingertips,
hesitating to plunge her hands into the bowels of the machine.
Diana urged her with a light touch.
I stared down a black bear, Liddy reminded herself.
She took a deep breath, fished out the broken ends, and began to tie the weaver's knot that Diana had shown her over and over again the afternoon before. Finally, Liddy managed to make a clumsy knot, and Diana pulled the lever, and the loom shuddered to life once more. How could she ever get accustomed to this inferno? Even when the girls were set free at 7, it was to push and shove their way across the bridge and down the street to their boarding houses, bolt down their hearty breakfast, and rush back, stomach still churning, for ring-in at 7:35. Nearly half the mill time was spent simply going up and down the staircase, across the mill yard and bridge, down the row of houses, just getting to and from the meal. And the din in the dining room was nearly as loud as the racket in the mill. 30 young women chewing and calling at the same time, reaching for the platters of flapjacks and pitchers of syrup, ignoring cries from the other end of the table to pass anything. Her quiet meals in the corner of the kitchen with Tryphena, even her meager bowls of bark soup in the cabin with the seldom talkative Charlie, seemed like feasts compared to the huge, rushed, noisy affairs in Mrs. Bedloe's house. The half hour at noonday dinner, with more food than she had ever had set before her at one time, was worse than breakfast. At last the evening bell rang, and Mr. Marsden pulled the cord to end the day. Diana walked with her to the place by the door where the girls hung their bonnets and shawls and handed Liddy hers.
"Let's forget about studying those regulations tonight," she said. "It's been too long a day already."
Liddy nodded.
Yesterday seemed years in the past.
She couldn't even remember why she'd thought the regulations important to bother with. She had lost all appetite. The very smell of supper made her nauseous. Beans heavy with pork fat and brown Injun bread with orange cheese, fried potatoes, of course, and flapjacks with applesauce, baked Indian pudding with cream, and plum cake for dessert. Liddy nibbled at the brown bread and washed it down with a little scalding tea. How could the others eat so heartily and with such a clatter of dishes and shrieks of conversation? She longed only to get to the room, take off her boots, massage her abused feet, and lay down her aching head. While the other girls pulled their chairs from the table and scraped them about to form little circles in the parlor area, Liddy dragged herself from the table and up the stairs. Betsy was already there before her, her current novel in her hand. She laughed at the sight of Liddy.
"The first full day, and up to now you thought yourself a strapping country farm girl who could do anything, didn't you?"
Liddy did not try to answer back. She simply sank to her side of the double bed and took off the offending shoes and began to rub her swollen feet.
"If you've got an older pair..." Betsy's voice was almost gentle, "more stretched and softer."
Liddy nodded. Tomorrow she'd wear Tryphena's without the stuffing. They were still stiff from the trip, and she'd be awkward rushing back and forth to meals, but at least there'd be room for her feet to swell. She undressed, slipped on her shabby night shift, and slid under the quilt. Betsy glanced over at her.
"To bed so soon?"
Liddy could only nod again. It was as if she could not possibly squeeze a word through her lips. Betsy smiled again.
"She ain't laughing at me," Liddy realized. "She's remembering how it was." "Shall I read to you?" Betsy asked.
Liddy nodded gratefully and closed her eyes and turned her back against the candlelight. Betsy did not give any explanation of the novel she was reading, simply commenced to read out loud where she had broken off reading to herself.
Even though Liddy's head was still choked with lint and battered with noise, she struggled to get the sense of the story. The child was in some kind of poorhouse, it seemed, and he was hungry. Liddy knew about hungry children. Rachel, Agnes, Charlie, they had all been hungry that winter of the bear. The hungry little boy in the story had held up his bowl to the poorhouse overseer and said, "Please, sir, I want some more." And for this, the overseer, she could see his little rosebud mouth rounded in horror. For this, the overseer had screamed out at the child. In her mind's eye, little Oliver Twist looked exactly like a younger Charlie. The cruel overseer had screamed and hauled the boy before a sort of agent. And for what crime? For the monstrous crime of wanting more to eat.
"That boy will be hung,"
the agent had prophesied.
"I know that boy will be hung."
She fought sleep, ravenous for every word. She had not had any appetite for the bountiful meal downstairs, but now she was feeling a hunger she knew nothing about. She had to know what would happen to little Oliver. Would he indeed be hanged just because he wanted more gruel? She opened her eyes and turned to watch Betsy, who was absorbed in her reading. Then Betsy sensed her watching and looked up from the book.
"It's a marvelous story, isn't it? I saw the author once, Mr. Charles Dickens. He visited our factory. Let me see, I was already in the spinning room. It must have been in..."
But Liddy cared nothing for authors or dates.
"Don't stop reading the story, please," she croaked out. "Never fear, little Liddy. No more interruptions," Betsy promised,
and read on, though her voice grew raspy with fatigue, until the bell rang for curfew. She stuck a hair ribbon in the place.
"Till tomorrow night,"
she whispered as the feet of an army of girls could be heard thundering up the staircase. Chapter 11. The Admirable Choice. The next day in the mill, the noise was just as jarring, and her feet in Tryphena's old boots swelled just as large. But now and again, she caught herself humming. "Why am I suddenly happy? What wonderful thing is about to happen to me?" And then she remembered. Tonight, after supper, Betsy would read to her again. She was, of course, afraid for Oliver, who was all mixed up in her mind with Charlie. But there was a delicious anticipation, like molded sugar on her tongue. She had to know what would happen to him, how his story would unfold. Diana noticed the change. "You're settling in faster than I thought," she said. But Liddy didn't tell her. She didn't quite know how to explain to anyone that it wasn't so much that she had gotten used to the mill, but she had found a way to escape its grasp. The pasted sheets of poetry or scripture in the window frames, the geraniums on the sill, those must be some other girl's way, she decided. But hers was a story. As the days melted into weeks, she tried not to think how very kind it was of Betsy to keep reading to her. There were nights, of course, when she could not, when there was shopping or washing that had to be done. On Saturday evenings, they were let out 2 hours early, and Amelia corralled Liddy and Prudence for long walks along the river before it grew too dark. Betsy, of course, did whatever she liked, regardless of Amelia. Sundays, Amelia dragged the reluctant Liddy to church. At first, Liddy had been afraid Betsy would go on reading without her. But Betsy waited until Sunday afternoon, when Amelia and Prudence were down in the dining room writing their weekly letters home, and she picked up the story just where she had stopped on the previous Friday evening. It was several weeks before Liddy caught on that the novel was from the lending library and thus cost Betsy 5 cents a week to borrow. On her own, Betsy could have read it much faster. Liddy was sure of that. As much as she hated to spend the money, on her first payday, Liddy insisted on giving Betsy a full 10 cents to help with Oliver's rent. Betsy laughed, but she took it. She, too, was saving her money, she confessed quietly to Liddy, and asked her not to tell, to go for an education. There was a college out west in Ohio that took female students. A real college, not a young lady's seminary. But don't tell Amelia, she said, her voice returning to its usual ironic tone. She'd think it unladylike to want to go to Oberlin. It seemed strange to Liddy that Betsy should care at all what Amelia thought. But Liddy, who had never had any ambition to be thought a lady, did find herself asking, "What would Amelia think?" and censoring her own behavior from time to time accordingly. Then, all too soon, the book was done. It seemed to have flown by, and there was so much, especially at the beginning, when Liddy was too tired and, try as she might, could not listen properly, so much at the beginning that she needed to hear again. Actually, she needed to hear the whole book again, even the terrible parts, dear Nancy's killing and the death of Sykes. She wished she dared to ask Betsy to read more, but she could not. Betsy had given her hours and hours of time and voice. And besides, with July nearly upon them, the three roommates were making plans for going home. The very word was like a blow to her chest. Home. If only she could go. But she had signed with the corporation for a full year of work. If she left, even just to see the cabin and visit for an hour or so with Charlie, she would lose her position. "And if you leave without an honorable discharge," the clerk had said, "not only will you never work at the Concord Corporation again, but no other mill in Lowell will ever engage you." Blacklisted. The word sent chills down her backbone. So she watched her roommates pack their trunks and listened as they chattered about whom